794 Sylvia June 8, 2008, Letter 2.5A, System Methodist Caliber Error Handling, and then Letter 2.5B on Documentation. Well, before we get for next time, you have to do more work yourself. And so you want to look a bit ahead in the lecture notes and see where there's a box for things to do. So I'm going to have you do them while in the lecture, but I just want you to be aware that they are there to be done. That's for
next session?
That's for the next week, so 2 weeks from
the weekend. Are you going to show them to us now? Or
yeah, no, they're there. I mean, if you look at page 61, actually before that, there's a box. Yep. 55 and 61, so there will be much more discussion, at least on the Nielsen book, because you assume to have read it, and we just sort of want to bring home the major points and insights from that.
And you want us to pull these out in class?
In class, yes. Because you may want to give it some thought ahead of time. I think there's just those two. I was looking at software more, but actually I saw just the two, because then it goes into usability of websites, and I don't think I have anything in there. All right, system methods. So by system methods, we don't mean display of data that we requested, but it's prompts for user input, giving feedback, including warnings, help, reporting on system status, and error messages. They are all system messages. And they are guidelines they should follow and give examples later on of things where those guidelines were not followed. So, be specific. A mistake occurred. It's not good. Could not find a file. It's not good. Could not find file X, whatever you requested. That's good. It would be even better than just saying it didn't find the file you specified. It had you type in a name, you typed in a file name, and it said it couldn't find that file.
Can you explain why?
Well, if there was no file by that name, there's not much to explain. But what can the system do to help?
Alternative spellings.
Yes. You'd say here are some similar spelled files.
Oh, as far as not found, some is better than others. If it can't be found because it was originally stored on a different disk or different drive, that's not now accessible. To let you know that, not just I couldn't find it.
Right.
I couldn't find it because the O drive isn't speaking to me today.
If the system knows it's there.
Yeah.
And if it does that, it actually could. That would be a different kind of message. So if you happen to have on your machine a directory of all the disk drives that at one time or other it accesses, then it could find it there, then it would say this file is on drive e-bit is not available right now, rather than the masses cannot find it. Mm-hmm. So that also goes on to be specific. The other method would be cannot open this file if it didn't find it. Sometimes they do that. Mm-hmm. And there are any of five different reasons why not. Among them, it's already open. So if you tell you, you know, I mean, some programs will tell you the file is already open, and some will tell you I cannot open it. So there's an art in making these brief, but still have them understood. That's not easy. Okay, be polite. So, I mean, this is a two-edged sort of. Cannot process your input, maybe one way of saying it, but the error can actually be determined, because this is a field that can take only digits, and there's a letter in it, then it actually wouldn't even need to say there's an error. I mean, you could flag error, but and debatable if that would be useful or not. But it could say, there's a character in this position, but this field allows only digits. Whether it should flag errors as error, I mean, some people are overly sensitive, and they would annoy the user if you tell them made an error. But it's obvious anyway, and it may be helpful to be told you made an error. So that's maybe just some, maybe depending on the audience. Maybe it says could not read your credit card number is incorrect, please re-enter. Seems like it would be okay. Actually, it's not correct, maybe not quite the right thing. We could not be found. Would be one. Because the number you input may be correct, but when they try to find it in your bank, there's an issue. That's a problem. So when it's instructions that do things in sequence, give them in that sequence. And it's easy to slip that, because in English we often say after this, do that. But after doing A, do B. But it's better to say do A, then B. Or say press F10 after entering the data. Enter the data, then press F10. Now, I'm not, now that I read it, I think that would be clearer. On that one, you could do a usability study. Because press F10 after you enter the data sounds perfectly natural. Is it really the best? Probably not. But whether it makes a difference on the usability study itself. So there are two method parameters I can think of. One is message length, and the other is message expression. So do you have images in the message? Do you have a screenshot or a partial screenshot of how it should look from what it is? And what to compare with what the user did, and so forth. So there are now, if this is directed at experts, a very short message may use as an indication just something went wrong here, and then we'll immediately recognize, oh, I made this stupid mistake again. But for a novice user, it may need some explanation. So that's an area of customization. If the system is really good, and if it knows who uses the computer, it could track which error message is already displayed in the long version. And after it displayed it 3 times the long version, then goes to the short version, assuming that now the user knows the reason. So that there could be adaptations on that one. One criterion for the software is whether the error messages can be modified. So that you could configure the software for the particular audience, because you know they will never get this error message. If I say it this way, they won't understand it. There are very few programs that actually do that. So messages could be about, let's say at the beginning, what prompt user for input, give feedback. And you also want to look at, not as a help or error, when it would be nice to have a message and there is none. So, if I save a document in WordPerfect, it will not give me any feedback. I mean, I just know from the disk drive wiring that it's saved. It might be nice to say document saved. You have to sort of draw ways making too much annoyance to the user versus and saying maybe you shouldn't say something. So in WordPerfect 5.1 they have a save as command, but a key. But whenever you save, it doesn't just save. It will display on the bottom of the screen a line with the file name. And if you want to, you can edit the file name at that point. And then press enter and you save the file under a new name. So that's the equivalent of pressing Control S now. In this present version of WordPerfect or Word or any program I know, Control S just saves. You have to, if you want to save under a different name, you have to think about that ahead of time. Now, the cost of the WordPerfect 5.1 method is the time it takes to look and the time to present. That may be worth it to prevent the case where you made some changes and you really want to preserve your old document. Except if you have turned on Keep a Backup and you save, and I didn't really want to save over my old document, this is really something I want to give a new name. You could then recover from that by going back and how do you rename? Let me think how you do it. Yeah, actually, it's not that simple for a user to do this, because if you save the file under a new name, the backup copy, so you did Control S. Then you say, wait a minute, I really wanted to preserve the previous version under its own name. I didn't want to override it. You still have the backup. But if you now save what you have on the screen with a new name, you have just made a new last backup copy, and the old previous backup is lost. unless your system has levels of backup, which I have not seen either root over perfect or any. It would be a good idea to be able to go five back in the back, you can't. So then if you want to change that name, you would have to close the document machine, then go into the directory, change the file name to the new one you wanted to do, and then change the backup file name to what it was originally. And then you can reopen the document, and then you can stop. Yes. Now, if this happens to you, I mean, if every 10th time you save a document, it happens to you, the WorkPerfect 5.1 method is probably more definitely more efficient over time, because every time it takes you a little bit of time to think about it and to save it as is. But you must know, if this happens to you only every 1,000 saves, then overall it's more efficient in one of the 1,000 cases to do the complex method. But those are the reason I'm talking about it here in WorkPerfect 5.1, when you save a document, it will give you a message that in effect asks you whether you want to save it under the same name or under a new name. And it gives you a chance to change it at that point. Control S, as used now without a message, doesn't give you that chance. And so you want to, when you evaluate software, you want to consider when there should be a message, but there is not. But that's hard to study, because you really have to then use the thing for a while and do different functions and say, wait a minute, here, and the quality of that type of evaluation really depends on the insight and the skill of the evaluator. And the evaluator almost has to be sort of a designer who knows what good design isn't, and there should be a method. All right. Help. Some of the things we already talked about briefly, so they are just revisited here. What was this, how we talked about? Then the other distinction here is whether the help messages are strictly generic to the program, or whether they include help that's based specifically on the content of files of a database. The one example I gave here, a pop-up list for possible values of a field that is populated from a table in a database. Okay, so instead of programming the actually it could be populated in two ways. In when you define a table in SQL, the table definition for a given field can indicate a number of possible values. So you define a field day of the week, and you could write that in there in the table definition, say possible values are Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, etc. Alternatively, you could have a table, just a one column table, that has as values Sunday, Monday. And now in that case, you would be unlikely to add another one, unless somebody changes the calendar. But there are certainly cases where there might be additional values. And in this particular case, the advantage of doing it to a table is that it's easily changed. You just have to add a new row to a table, rather than changing a table definition. is always more cumbersome. So, but in this case, to display the possible values, the system would have to know the association between the data field and the table that stores the possible values. I don't know whether you could define that, but let's assume it knew that. Then it could, the help method, say, so the user says, I don't know what to do, or the user types in something that's not allowed. And then the system could say, this is not an allowed value. The allowed value is all. That's a help message that's based on the data in the system. And it would appear only on this particular, when interacting with this particular database. It would not appear using Oracle on some other database. Whereas if it's defined as a date field, okay, that's sort of in between. If it's not a date field, then all they would use is general error checking and help messages for filling in data to a date field. When should help be given? There are three scenarios. One is anticipation that the user may do an error. Well, one example of this is if a user is using a bibliographic database on OPAC and has issued 5 queries and never looked at any document records. Now, it may be that, I mean, that's another, by the way, it's a feedback message. It would be good to say your query found X number of documents. And so when that number was too high every time, they may choose not to look at it. But it's really a small action. They seem not to know how to narrow their question. So maybe it would be time to give an error, to give a message that says, perhaps you might want to look at some of the documents you found, because that might give you some idea on how to change your query. Now, if a user sends the same query in 5 times, it's definitely time for an anticipatory help message. And that happens. And children do all kinds of things. I think submitting the same query 5 times, an adult would be less likely to do, but a child might. Okay. So there, another reason that's given here is if from usability testing it turns out that half the time people make this error here, well, actually it would be time to change the program. But if you can't, the next best thing would be to sort of give a help message that warns people of that error so they won't make it. So anticipatory help is one. Help on request, that's when you actually push the help button. And okay, we'll talk about context sensitivity again in a minute. Or help after an error. So, instead of giving just an error message, it might be useful to give some help on how to detect the error. Okay, that's one. Or it could give the error message and then display a help screen, which would look to the user to be almost the same, but within the system it's different. Because if the error message includes the help, then that's part of the error message design. In the other case, it's just if error 125 is made, after the error message, pull up help screen C57. Okay. Or you could give the error message and then give help only when the user requests it. In which case one would hope this is context sensitive, so if I request help immediately after an error, it shouldn't give me the content, the general initial scheme for help. It should give me the help that focuses on this particular error, if the system is able to do that. Now, why would you not, I mean, what would be a hard from a rephrase question? What would be a reason for not displaying a help message after every error message automatically?
Because somebody may be doing something that the user program doesn't understand. I have times when I'm using a program and I don't want it to keep telling me that I'm doing it wrong if I'm doing something I want to do. You just annoyance factor.
Well, no, it may give you the error message. Now, if he doesn't know how to correct it, that would be a reason not to give the user a help message.
Yeah. An experienced user it may be a simple mistake. For a while our access database was set up so we couldn't have two entries with the same accession number. And so the error message would just read that entry already exists. And I don't need an explanation of why it already exists and how to fix it. I know that I just have to change the last digit on it and make a bigger number.
Right.
I don't need all the extra information.
Right. So the user may already know what to do. By the way, in your particular example, that is poor system design in terms of facilitating input. Because the user should not make the accession number, the system should. And that error would never occur.
They should now. It was left open originally because we were using pre-assigned accession numbers. So they thought it would be easier since the books already have the numbers to be able to enter them. So now at the point where I'm adding new stuff in, yeah, it would be nice if it's just next entry is the next number.
Right.
And that if I had one that needed to be changed, that I could go into the spreadsheet view and add it differently. But in the
Form
view, it should pop up the next one each time. But I'm still working on convincing the programmer
or
some other things first.
So, I mean, just as an example to follow this through, the real way to solve this would be to have a default. And so you show the next accession number in a window, in a little field, mm-hmm. and if the user wants it, but it's enter, if the user doesn't want it, type in another one, but it's enter. That's good. How you would know which one is the next one in that case would be a little more tricky. So that might, it would not be the simple access function, gives the next number. All right. So we already talked about context sensitivity. If a user requests help after an error and it's then displaced, a message immediately on how to deal with this error, that's context sensitive. On the other hand, if any request to help just gives you that first screen where it says content, find, search, it's not context sensitive. But actually, I think we did talk about that. So do I need to say any more about context sensitivity? Remember, if you are at a certain point, the program knows you're at a certain point, it could give you help about that point. So if you're in a table, it would give you help. At least it would display in that first screen the part of the content that deals with table history. Many programs do have, how do you do it? If you click, if some option is highlighted but not yet selected, I mean, not yet. Double click to actually do it. It may give you help on the high level option. But they are, some of them, for certain, if there is a window open, that's a certain thing. That obviously the help button in that window. So then that will give you help with doing whatever that window is supporting.
I have that kind of help with this. If I get halfway through and I don't know which the next command is I should use, I pull up the help menu and it gives me a list of commands.
Okay.
And it works very well, especially when I'm first learning how to use a, like, I'm just first learning how to put in entries into an address book in here because it's different.
Mm-hmm.
And so it helps when I get stuck to have a list of commands brought up so I can look at them.
Right, so that's when you are in the process.
Yeah.
And it knows where this process you are, and you say, help.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Then it will give you what to do next.
Yep.
That's good. Help with online documentation we talked about. So let me just talk a little bit about error handling. The first principle, of course, is avoid errors. You cannot do typos from menu selection. If there's a telephone number field and you type a character in it, it should beep. And that's the deleted error message. And you would probably know why it beeped. If you didn't, you would ask for help and it would tell you. So the next thing is important, the more control the user has, the more chance for error. So a lot of errors occur in writing programs, JavaScript and such, but I don't think any of you evaluate that kind of software, and the course is not really geared primarily to evaluating that kind of software, but there the error messages would loom much larger. Okay. So the program has to find the error in the first place, which may not be so easy, announce the error to the user, and then correct it. For spell check, that would be an example. If you do a spell check on the fly, I would never do that because it interrupts the flow. But you could have the system beep at you if you type something wrong and suggest, make a suggestion, you make the selection go on. Sometimes they do correct errors automatically. And there's a certain control you have about that. But to be perfect, I know how it works, but I don't. But to be perfect, there's a list of rules that you can auto correct. So whenever you misspell something, and the closest sort of spelling is one of those lists of rules, it will correct it. If you let it, it will correct. If you start a word with two capitals, it will do the second one and make it one.
The other new one, I think it's newer, that Word has, is if you read just the letter I by itself, it capitalizes it.
Right.
Which is a real pain when you're like me and you get typing too fast and you need to type it or is or if, and then you've got to go back and change two letters instead of just adding one on.
Oh, you mean it doesn't change it back when you type T after it?
No.
Okay. So how long does it wait? Oh, after the space, I see.
Yeah, so if I hit I space and I made a mistake, by the time I'm backspace, corrected it to a capital I.
I see. So if it was really small, it would correct it back to lowercase I.
Yeah.
And you put, then you put T right after it. Unless it's after a period.
Yeah.
I hate it in Word when you indent something and it decides that you must be doing a list.
Yeah, I hate that. I really
want
to go in and turn that off.
I wouldn't call that as error handling. I mean, that falls under the general heading the programmer knows best.
Yeah, it's annoying.
And,
you're a failure.
But it falls under the principle of system messages this is an example where there should be a message. Mm-hmm. And it could ask you, do you mean to start a list?
Yeah, it does that.
It does?
Yeah, and then you have to start typing to say no.
To say no? Okay. I see. So...
I mean, it depends. I've seen it both. I've had it just do it, and I've had it ask me.
But the way I know, it just does it. I was never asked. So if it asks, it's one step above. But then, what would be still one step above if your next action is to type something, it would take it as a no response.
I work on math and a Windows machine, so I probably...
Right, but that would be, I mean, that would be a good way to do it.
If you could just shut it off by ignoring it, but I think usually you have to hit something.
Because often, I mean, sometimes it is helpful to get this list done automatically. Mm-hmm. But just do it when I ask, but don't do it without asking.
All your Office, like your Outlook 2007, does it so that you're here in the middle of an email and you start a list that starts indenting all kinds of crazy stuff like you're doing an outline. And it also does it in Word, so you have to go down and shut them off.
Right. But there is if you know where to find it, there is a way to turn that off.
Yeah, if you can find it.
But it's very hard to find. Yes.
Oh.
No, I mean, it should be under customization, but many customizations now are actually buried in the application itself. Mm-hmm. So, spell check customization that you don't want grammar check, you cannot do under customizations in there. You can only do when the spell check is open. And you can then you can uncheck it. And this autocorrect is probably somewhere in edit or somewhere in tools and autocorrect, and that's where you can probably do it. But in any event, so there is detecting errors, announcing errors with the user and correcting them. There's error message guidelines, which I provided you a copy for. There's also an interesting problem that the error message may come from a program outside the one you are just in. Maybe it's an operating system error message.
Yeah.
Not a message from Word. No. All the error messages are actually correct, because sometimes they are not. They may say cannot open this file, but it's already open. Well, I'm not sure if you call this correct. It's just at very least misleading. When you want to debug some SQL statements, that may be problematic because the actual, I mean, it may give you one error message, but it may actually be caused by some punctuation missing five lines above. That's true for much programming. To some extent, that's unavoidable. But I'll give you another example. In the Thesaurus Manager, that has a lot of error messages when it processes a file. I mean, for anything that processes a file, reads in a file, there should be error messages. Which are in the log, but they're not happening as doesn't stop processing that, just in a log. And so sometimes people do a hard return on the scope note. They're not supposed to do that. The scope note is supposed to be one paragraph, which the program interprets as starting a new term. And then the next line starts with five periods, five levels down. So obviously the program will issue an error message that says, the level is increasing more than one. The level should never increase more than one, the hierarchic level. So somebody looks at this, there's a level increasing more than one. The scope note. Well, it's a hard term. They may not even see that this one if they don't do a reveal code or show the paragraph mark piece. And so the error message is entirely correct from the program's point of view, but still not understandable to the inexperienced user. So after that user has spent an hour to figure this one out, the next time it happens, they will know. So there are some bad error messages. Some of them are very old, but it doesn't really matter how old they are. Unable to accept. unable to create directory of entry. And it doesn't tell you why. In the old DOS, the root directory could not have more than 512 characters under it.
I used to get bad command of file name, but it never told me why.
Yes, yes. So these are all non-specific.
Yeah.
Yeah, and data cannot open file when the file is already open. and I'm not sure who still uses iOmega zip drives. I think I still use them because I'm a legacy kind of person. So in the old version it says couldn't install the. No drive level. So when you install it, you should add a new drive level. No drive level added.
Yeah.
And it doesn't tell you why. And actually, the reason was all the drive levels in DOS are exhausted. The newer version gave the reason. The idea is you need to give the reason so the user knows what to do. Error messages that just tell you there's an error and let them hanging. I'm not good. And they are still happening in new systems just as well. Other methods are like they are in the Windows directory, doesn't tell you how much space is free. Cool. The default directory display does not give file extensions. Tries to be nuts. I mean, that's the first thing I change. And I think because I have a little icon with the file type, they know the extension is all. That again, it's too much hidden from the user.
No pain in doing website designs with HTML and HTML, both .html and .html websites. But if you put the wrong one in the code, it can't find it.
Yeah.
Right.
Figure out which stupid one it is that has the wrong.
Yes.
And then you're there for hours looking for it.
Or another missing sort of method or display in all those processes. I mean, many writers write against a limit, either in terms of characters, or in terms of words, or bytes, or length, or whatever. So it would be very helpful to have that displayed all the time, rather than having to go somewhere or even push a button.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I put in WorkPerfect, I put a button for the count on my main toolbar, but it would be still better to just see it, and you may need to be able to customize it, because for character limits. Some are done with spaces, and some without spaces. I remember, I think my son's wife, when I was visiting them, she was sending in some application where they had get an abstract of her research. It was limited to 300 characters, which is not a lot. And so she limited the 300 characters, counting in words without spaces, and tried to submit it and said, it's too big. Because their measure was with spaces. So you may have to be able to customize what's shown in the display for that reason. There's a famous method, press any key to continue.
Oh, no.
And then one help desk, the most often asked question was,
where
is the any key? So just say press enter to continue. If any key, see, in this case, the actually through message is not the right message to give. Just tell the user what to do in this case, press enter, it's easy key to find. You're done. But the library master method, I love that one too. you find this out by experience. That's hard to test or evaluate because you really have to use the program for a while to figure this one out. Okay. I think this is an item on pages. I'm looking at my watch. I'm going to have to. You can read those and explain themselves. So let's look at the whole area of documentation. Okay, so as usual in systems analysis, you should start with the purpose. Why do we need documentation? Well, it's close to home. For your project, you need good documentation of the software in order to evaluate it. And that's a perfectly good reason, obviously. Then the second is to be able to run the program, which means installation. Now, of course, these days you have this, what do they call it? For hardware, they call it
plug and play.
For software, it should work. But as often as not, it doesn't. And so then you need to be able to look at the documentation and see what are the reasons, possible reasons for the error. Customization. So you need to have documentation that helps you, or that either intuitive interface or help or documentation of some kind to tell you how to make macros, or how to customize other things. As we just saw, to customize world is not always easy. And maybe in help they will tell you where to customize something. Learning and training, part of documentation. Daily use. Maintenance, say what happens if you upgrade the operating system, does the software still run? And you need documentation about that. So we talked about this before. Ideally you wouldn't need documentation. You could just run it. But for very simple programs it might work. For more complex programs, but even to know what it does, difficult. I think I just listened on the radio to some discussion of video cameras, and apparently there's one that person liked, and that video camera had only one big red button. You press it to start recording, and you press it to stop. That's all the controls you have. And if you just want to take simple videos, that's fine, because a complex camera, you may never figure out how to do it. Okay, I think what is the other famous example for remote controls. They're famous for not being useful. But there is in cybernetics, they have they call the law of requisite variety. So some device has only one output. You don't need any input, right? So it always puts out the same thing. But if it has a choice of two outputs, there has to be at least two inputs. Tell it, put this thing out, put that thing. If it has 200 outputs, unless they are random, I mean, we ignore that one. If there are 200 outputs that are determined by some thing that happened from the environment, it must be able to receive differentiated input in order to decide which of the 200 outputs to choose. So The more the options are what you can do with software, the more complex is the operation of it, and the more important becomes documentation. And do without any documentation, I think it can be done only for very simple software. It also depends on what kind of software it is. If it is a word processor that does all the usual things you expect the word processor to do, and has some icons that are reasonably easy to understand, and or command names that are easy to understand, and it uses the keyboard in obvious ways, then somebody who knows word processors may be able to use that program without a manual. But what somebody who uses a word processor the first time ever in their life, any word processor, They could not use it without a manual, right? Okay. So a third function of the documentation is to make modifications possible. In the fourth, which is actually quite important for the producer, is to monitor the development of the program. And if it's a big programming project, there'll be 20 programmers working on it. And programmer 3 works on this module. Well, unless that module is documented, how it works and what it does, what input it takes, what output it produces, how other programmers are supposed to build their stuff to work with it. And the documentation there is essential just to support the development. And, that's sort of different kind of documentation, but still documentation. So what are parts of documentation? Reviews. Most people wouldn't say so, but if you look at documentation broadly and wherever it's available, reviews, and sometimes they tell you how to do it. And sometimes that's the only place where you find it decently explained, how this function works. A demo. Useful. A user's guide or manual, we talked about that. Tutorial piece, a reference manual, reference call, those we discussed very briefly. The software evaluation criteria checklist needs to deal with all of these things. So this is sort of an elaboration on the brief pieces we did there, and so I am skipping something here very done there. Brief data sheet describing exactly what the program needs for environment. Be useful. Performance data document. So where you have a document that describes how long it took to do X, Y, and Z. For that, you may have to pay. And there are companies that make it their business to do very detailed testing of software, including performance in terms of time. And response time, those kinds of things. And then they will produce reports, and they'll sell it to you for $500. And that may seem expensive for 5 pages, but it will cost you $10,000 to do a book. Okay, so they really have to sell 20 of them to break even. So to sell through, they make some money. There could be a system manual, okay, that explains not only what the software does, but only how it does it, and maybe even, on the last one, description not of the program. Part of it may be in the system manual, or part of that may be even more detailed, and that's what the people need to maintain it. And why was this written this way? And particularly if the programmer is very clever. To understand what the programmer did may be very hard. My own program, I did copious notes, but I still came and I wanted to change something. Now, how does this, what are the things there? How does this exactly work? So then when I figured it out, looking at the code a second time, I put it in as a comment. Right then and there, so if I would come back a year later, I would understand. I haven't looked at this software for a long time to change it. I wonder how much I would still understand how it works. That kind of documentation is often neglected. And so the programmer leaves. The company produces. All the knowledge on how the program works is now gone. And you want to, some customer requires some modification. Forget it. Maybe that's why I don't update PowerMark anymore. Maybe the programmer who knew how it worked left the company and didn't leave good documentation, then it's hard to do. The forms of documentation, we talked about that. It may be just a little bit more complete. And now my stepson does a genealogy program. And he, I think he produced 4 or 5 videotapes that with screenshots show Sukkot go through the program. It's sort of like a tutorial he might give at some, he does that too at a conference, but documentation. And they sell because people want to learn how to work the program and being guided through the program with the really say where they can see, and then they can replicate the same thing on their own machine, and they can run, they can start and stop. That's useful to have. It's useful for learning. I think that's all that's new here. Sources, we talked about that. The we didn't talk about the evaluation criteria as much as we should have. So the first one is very simply, is it available from wherever? And of course cost. So if it's available free, so much the better. If it's available for a cost, then that will, and it's not available free elsewhere in the same quality, and you really need that book on Word to run it well in your company, then that's part of the cost. It's simple. Coverage. One very useful thing is a list of the errors. And errors often have, well, either by text or in a, well, I mean, when you debug a program, those error messages all have a number. Error number 1231.
Yeah.
And then they will have a list of errors by number, and they will say possible reasons for this all. And sometimes it may really be hard for the program to figure out what the reason is. Sometimes it's just laziness of the program that the error message doesn't give you the reason right away, other than you having to investigate it. If the errors are not numbered, it may be useful to have one alphabetically by text so you can look it up and it will explain and give you background and tell you what to do. How detailed is the documentation? How clear is it? I mean, can you really understand it? Some of this prose is just not understandable. If the programmers write the error messages, forget it. It really takes a technical writer who can write this from a user's point of view. Now, for the documentation that describes how the program works, you may need the programmer, but then you need somebody else to read it and see whether they can actually understand how the program works, and if not, has to, the text has to be changed. So there's clarity of the arrangement and clarity of the writing. Do they give examples? Examples, I mean, how to fix an error. Examples are extremely important to understand exactly how to do things. If it's command driven, an example of a command. If you want to document SQL, give examples. Because that's what helps people learn. The abstract description is usually it's necessary, but it's hard to deal with often. And I may not read the abstract description. I might just use the example as a model and write my thing the same way, and it works. So a lot of when I do programming, a lot of it is copying some program that's known to work. It's maybe my own I figured out 2 years ago, but now I don't know anymore how it works, and I don't really want to investigate all the details anymore. I just do it the same way, and I said, here I have to do this magic incantation. It will work. So examples are important. How easy is it to find answers? So documentation should be accessible by problems to be solved. And they may be hard to do because you then really need to get into what kind of task do you just want to do, and what kind of formula is the one to a document, and what this and that. And so you have to have a list of tasks. And you have to have it classified. Because if the user could name the task, often they can't name the task. They can just have in their mind a concept. So they have to say, well, it has to do with fitting the text in a certain space. And that should eventually lead them to when the character spacing, I think. I mean, when you can actually modify how close characters are spaced. You can use it in kick in and say, scrunch this and make it 95%. And then that may just make this fit on a line, which then may just fit this page on a text, so the page break occurs at a section break. That's, by the way, it's the same principle by which you should have a line break at a sensible space. To have a section run over two lines to the next page and then have a major section of your paper sort doesn't help clarity. So it's better then to somehow shorten the previous text so that section 2 ends on the bottom of page 4 and section 3 starts on the top of page 5. And sometimes it needs trickery. Like in this line, we just want to scrunch the text a little bit. And 95% doesn't detract from readability a lot. If you do it to 80%, it will be hard to read. And so, but again, how a user doesn't know this can be done. All they know is the task of fitting the text. How do they find that particular function? I mean, I use it all the time, and I now even forget the name of it. And that needs a classified arrangement of tasks where the user can look. The problem index. Then the computer searchable documentation. All the things we talked about display design clearly apply to documentation, right? And so I don't need to go over that again. Question?
Are we
supposed to include the 5 articles that were supposed to annotate, or is it just other documentation that we find? The bibliography should contain at least what you intend to read. For the introductory materials, the very beginning, page 3, 2.1. This is the literature on the function the software supports. So if you want to support homework, you have to find some literature that discusses how students do homework and what difficulties they encounter and what are the functions of doing a homework assignment, what are the steps and all that. There must be stuff written about that. And so it must be included. And how a program can support this. And it should have a software review that you will do the annotations for, yes.
So we should have all the reviews that
Yes, all the and those are, remember, those are reviews about different software packages that fall into the type of software you're doing.
It's
okay.
Not all the reviews you're ever going to have,
though. No, because once you found your particular software you're going to evaluate in depth, then you look for more reviews on that software.
Just the ones that we need, the annotated ones that we need to turn in by
first. Yeah. Right. But if you haven't found them all, these deadlines are sort of to move you along. If you fall behind, then to be finished by the June, July 21st will be more difficult. If you have difficulty getting done by then, just let me know. It's all we can adapt to your schedule. There are no outside reasons for deadlines.
Are we using APA class?
No. Actually, I prefer if you bold the title of the piece. And the rest of it, do whatever you like to do.
Some of the reviews are, like some of the ones that the comparative ones are going to hit several different programs.
That's fine. They may actually be very useful for this purpose.
So you still need five of them. You may be double covering a lot of different.
That's fine. Yeah.
Do you want us to email you what we...
Yep.
Okay. So we email you a bibliography by Thursday, and then notes and a preliminary evaluation checklist the following on Sunday.
Yep.
And then that's all the deliverables we have until we see you.
Yeah, yeah. And I will endeavor to respond to your bibliography quickly. I should have web access at Thursday evening.
I can picture these notes looking like a whole lot of different things. Do you have a picture of what you've got in mind?
Whatever suits your purpose. Eventually, you have to write something about.
Mm-hmm.
When you do the software evaluation, you have to say this software support is to support homework, and homework entails this task, entails these different functions. This is how software in general can support these functions. So you have to write something, and your notes should support what you eventually come up with as a new paper.
Those notes are going to become the evaluation of actually.
They will feed into the evaluation. They will become, I mean, once the deduction of the evaluation will come from these notes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Any other questions? You can also email me questions. If you email them before tomorrow, like around noon, I will answer them quickly. I think then the next time I have web access is probably sometime on Tuesday. Unless the airport is done, the Newark airport will then have that access easily.
Some of the reviews and articles are going to have funky looking bibliographies, because I know some of them, I don't know how to do bibliographies for some of these educational website locations, if you try to follow a format of it, God help you.
Yeah.
As long as you've got a title.
Give a title and URL, it's fine.
Okay.
But there's another example for software function. How can you support this task, this software, and what you do? You have a good bibliography manager, and it asks you which data to put in which way, and it has 500 different formats, and you pick one, and it rearranges the. So what I described about how you should be able to do several rules on the same web page. That's exactly what the bibliography manager does, because it's a much simpler problem for bibliographic citation.
Yeah.
It asks you the information, the detailed version, so you have to put the year and the month and the volume and the number and the page number. It is a different field because different formats rearrange arrange those pieces of data in different ways. But from this basic, very detailed record, which they guide you in preparing, they arrange it, and you don't have to worry about it. Okay, don't suffocate in the heat. And I will see you in approximately 2 weeks. End of this lecture.